It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Bastille Day, and we explore the history of the French in Wisconsin.
First, lead levels in Milwaukee children are found to be among the highest in the nation, and some legislators say part of the problem is that state lead poisoning standards are out of date.
Years ago, after studies showed that even a slight rise in blood lead levels could dramatically affect a child's IQ, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention cut the allowable lead limit in blood by half.
But Wisconsin didn't follow suit, which means that children often go undiagnosed and untreated until their blood levels are double that of the national standard.
With us now is State Representative Chris Taylor from Wisconsin's 76th Assembly District in the Madison area. Representative Taylor, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we've heard a lot about lead in water, of course, in Flint, Michigan, elsewhere around the country. Before we get to what you want to see change here in the law, how big a problem do you see this being here in Wisconsin?
Well, it's a big problem. Lead poisoning is an issue that affects rural and urban communities, Democrat and Republican districts, and it's an issue all over the state. If you look at percentage of tested children with elevated blood lead levels, in so many of our communities, it's higher than it is in Flint, Michigan. In the city of Milwaukee, it's higher. In the city of Watertown, in Buffalo County, Rock County, the city of Racine. So we have unacceptably high levels of blood poisoning of children in many different communities throughout Wisconsin.
And why is this such an important health concern, this issue of lead affecting children in particular?
Well, lead poisoning, there's no amount really that's safe for children. It can cause significant permanent damage. It causes brain damage, which obviously reduces intelligence. It's connected with learning disabilities, developmental delays. A study done in Milwaukee found that early lead exposure prospectively predicted fourth grade suspensions. The study also found that lead exposure explained 23% of the racial discipline gap that we see in the state of Wisconsin. So it has profound effects for a child throughout that child's life.
One of the things you're trying to tackle here is different standards here in Wisconsin versus federal recommendations. Can you talk us through that?
Sure. Well, I recently did a bill that would bring Wisconsin in line with federal guidelines on what constitutes lead poisoning and when do you need to intervene to mitigate lead poisoning. Unfortunately, here in Wisconsin, our standards are twice as high as federal standards. We don't consider a child to have or be lead poisoned until they have a level of lead in the blood of 10 or more micrograms per 100 milliliters of blood. That is twice as much as what is required with the federal standards. The federal standards say a child is lead poisoning when they have 5 or more micrograms. So our standard requires a child to experience significant more contamination before there's any mitigation that is done, before there's any attempt to identify the source of the lead and any attempt to mitigate where that lead's coming from. In addition, the CDC guidelines, the Center for Disease Control, the federal guidelines require intervention at the level of 5 micrograms. Our state law doesn't require intervention until 15 or more micrograms per 100 milliliters of blood. So it's almost 3 times the contamination levels that's required before the state does any kind of intervention. That's not acceptable. That is really endangering children's lives, and we need to immediately comply with what our state law says. Our state law says that we should be in compliance with the federal standards, that the Department of Health Services should pass a rule when federal standards change to make sure that we are compliant. That has not happened in the state of Wisconsin. So our children really are being endangered. They're not being considered to be lead poisoned, even when they significantly exceed the federal guidelines, and the state's not intervening in time.
As I understand it, you got in touch with the state agency to see why we hadn't changed that standard to match that federal guideline. What did you hear?
Well, I heard a real unacceptable response. I heard that the department, this is the Department of Health Services, has considered this issue since the CDC created its current value that defines lead poisoning in 2012. So the department has been thinking about it for 4 years and not acting on it. And it seems like they're not acting on it because there is not the money to to intervene at that level, at that 5 microliters level. And so we have old standards, they're out of date, they're not complying with the CDC standards, and we're not intervening to make sure that we're identifying the cause of lead poisoning and remediating so other children aren't contaminated and poisoned.
If we change the standard here in Wisconsin to match that federal guideline, but we don't have the resources to mitigate, to change lead water feeds, that sort of thing, will this make any difference, changing that standard, if we can't ultimately do much about it?
Well, we must do something about it. The cost of not doing something about it far exceed the cost of remediating. You know, we have a $72 billion budget here in the state of Wisconsin. We believe we would need probably about $4 million more dollars allocated to remediation. We must make it a priority. We have the resources. We need to make it a priority to make sure that kids aren't being contaminated with lead poisoning that impacts the rest of their lives.
We're talking to State Assembly Representative Chris Taylor about her efforts on lead in Wisconsin's water supplies, the effect on children in particular. Representative Taylor, given that there's this gap in standards between Wisconsin and the country, is it possible that there are a lot of cases that at the national level would be considered a kid with lead poisoning that are just under the radar? We don't know they're out there because we're not watching for it. We're not setting off alarm bells at those levels.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. We know when these tests are done on children that the levels are very, very high in communities throughout the state. And it doesn't seem to be one community or one type of community that is impacted. It's all kinds of communities impacted, suburban, urban, rural. And, you know, we need to be doing more to treat these incidents, to identify, first of all, instances of lead poisoning, and to make sure we're doing everything we can to remediate so other children don't suffer lifelong health consequences as a result.
You mentioned you're working on legislation to make the state, in effect, comply with that federal guideline. What else? Is there anything else in that legislation or that you would see as a next step?
Right, yes. It also requires remediation. So it requires that when a child meets that CDC definition of lead having lead poisoning, that the state is required to go in and not just test paint, because paint, old paint and paint chips are a source of lead poisoning, but to also test the water. That is not being done currently. There is no testing of the water for potential lead poisoning.
And then what? We've talked about the resource issue a little bit. Would it take, more funding in the state budget next time around?
Right.
What would it take to get this remediation and probably more funding for testing, for that matter?
That's right. Well, you know, the tests are being done. There are standards for testing to be done. 1 and 2 year old children who are on Badger Care, they're supposed to be tested. So I do think that the testing is being done. I'm not hearing that it's not. But what we need to do is allocate the money so that cities and individuals do get assistance, because it is the individual who is responsible for doing the remediation. So there's a lot of different possibilities in that. We could establish some kind of tax credit for it. We could establish some kind of fund that individuals can get reimbursed from when they go ahead and do the remediation. But it is going to require money. And so that's going to need to happen either in the budget process. And I unfortunately am currently on the budget committee, and so this is a big priority of mine. Or it needs to happen in a separate bill that has an appropriation attached to it.
Local governments sometimes have taken the lead on this. I know Madison has gotten national attention for efforts to completely get lead out of the water service. Are you seeing other local efforts not waiting for the state to take action?
Yeah, absolutely. There are other efforts happening. I know there's some cities that are establishing programs, funds to set aside that are assisting with individuals and families who are wanting to mitigate lead. So we are seeing that in some communities. But cities also, what we hear throughout the state, are struggling too. They don't have extra resources to devote to this. So it is a state issue. This has statewide public health impacts. And it is imperative that the state take the lead in making sure we're doing everything we can to stop stop lead poisoning and address it when we know it's occurring.
You're out of session now, of course, but are you hearing from Republican colleagues that they'd want to be on board with something like this?
I have had several discussions with some of my Republican colleagues who are concerned about this because it's their communities, too, that are being impacted. So, you know, I'll be doing everything I can to make sure that as we move forward, we do have bipartisan support.
And a timeline on this for when you get back into session next year?
Immediately. It's critically important. So this is really one of the first bills that I'm going to introduce when we come back in January.
Representative Taylor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was State Representative Chris Taylor from Wisconsin's 76th Assembly District. Today is Bastille Day, a day that commemorates the storming of a French prison sparking the bloody French Revolution. Closer to home and closer to our time, Milwaukee is observing Bastille Day today with a festival and a celebration of French culture starting today in the city's Cathedral Park.
Anne LaPlaye joins us now to talk about Bastille Day and the history of the French in Wisconsin. She's the executive director of the Alliance Française de Milwaukee, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to promote French language and cultural exchange. Anne, welcome to Central Time.
Hello.
So, Anne, how is Bastille Day observed in France today and, you know, closer to home here in Wisconsin?
Well, in France, it's a one-day festival that resembles a lot our 4th of July. There tends to be military parades, jet fighters. Many of us have seen the Champs-Élysées parade in central Paris, but pretty much those types of parades are in every city. And then at night there are music in the street and little what they would call a little ball. So there people dance in the streets to a band often put in the street. So it really resembles our 4th of July, and it's a one-day festival. The festival that we have in Milwaukee is the biggest in North America. It lasts 4 days and attracts 200,000 people. And we're celebrating the 35th year this year.
Oh, so that's we get more people, well, not more people, but a longer event at least here in Wisconsin. Why is it such a big deal here in Wisconsin?
It was created in 1981 by François Niveau, who was a general manager of the Pfister Hotel at the time, and he was a Frenchman. And he wanted to attract people back to the downtown. This was a time when instead of people coming to Grand Avenue and the shops downtown, they were flocking to Mayfair and Bayshore. And he and the other businesses downtown really wanted to create something to attract people back downtown. And there was Bastille Day, so this July event, and in addition wanted to sort of highlight the French history of Milwaukee. I don't know if people know, but Solomon Juneau, who was a French Canadian, was the first mayor of Milwaukee, and Easttown is sort of where the origins of Juneau Town, so really the very first beginnings of Milwaukee, happened. And, in fact, if you walk down Kilbourn Street East, you hit Juneau Park and a sculpture of Solomon Juneau, the first mayor of Milwaukee.
Wow. And what year would that have been?
1846.
Well, let's go broader now and talk about the history of the French in Wisconsin in general. When did the first French explorers and settlers turn up here in the state?
It was in the 1600s. Jean Nicolet, and we've all heard of Nicolet, was sent to travel the St. Lawrence River to explore the waterways in search of a route from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and instead Nicolet discovered Wisconsin. So the very first Europeans to come to Wisconsin were French, Nicolet, Joliet, Father Marquette, and they were sent to draw maps of the region. And so the first maps were made by French people, and they took the Indian words and wrote them how a French person would write. So, in fact, the first spelling of Wisconsin was O-U-I-S-C-O-N-S-I-N. And wow. It stayed that way for the first 100 years of the state. And then when we Wisconsin started having more English speakers, they switched the OUI to WI, Wisconsin, the way we know it now.
Interesting story, and I guess I don't think about Wisconsin as being a heavily French state. I mean, I think about the German roots here and Scandinavian, but how French would you say Wisconsin is?
Not that French. I mean, there were a lot more German, Italian, Polish settlers, but because the French were the first to draw maps, there's a really heavy French presence in the names that you find in Wisconsin. So Racine, for example, means root. And what's interesting is they kept the French word for the city, but they changed the river's name to the English word root. Fond du lac is a French word meaning bottom of the lake. You have, of course, words like Marquette and Beloit, which are names of people. And then Lac du Flambeau, Prairie du Sac, Prairie du Chien, those are all French names and are basically Indian words that were translated into French.
It's fun to hear you pronounce them like that. I'm so used to hearing them
pronounced a little differently.
Right, exactly. So were there ever those waves of immigration like we did see with the Germans, for instance? Maybe it didn't stick, but were there any French waves?
Not as strong as the German and the others and the Irish, etc. What we're seeing now are maybe bigger waves of French speakers who are not necessarily from France. So there's a growing community of West Africans who speak French, Haitians. There are some people from Quebec, but they're really spread out just like the French are.
We're talking with Anne LaPlay right now, Executive Director of the Alliance Française de Milwaukee, a nonprofit organization who's there to promote French language and cultural exchange. And we're talking about the history of French influence here in Wisconsin. Today is Bastille Day, the storming of the Bastille, if you remember your history. And looking more beyond the maps, the cartography and the naming, how did the French influence Wisconsin culture?
They had a minor influence. There's obviously the French name, but what's really interesting is a similarity between France and Wisconsin. So both France and Wisconsin have states that are the shape of hexagons, and they have bodies of water that are important. But one way the French has influenced Wisconsin is the dairy products, especially cheese. So there are a lot of French cheesemakers that are spread out within Wisconsin, and Wisconsin has really become an important cheese-producing state.
Is there anything particular to the way the French cheesemakers produce their cheese that's in contrast maybe to the Wisconsin, the non-French influenced cheesemakers?
One important difference between France and Wisconsin is the idea of pasteurized cheese. I think in France you're allowed to have cheese that's not pasteurized, whereas in Wisconsin cheese has to be pasteurized according to the health code, so it creates sort of different cheeses. So in France you're going to have things that are, a little bit stronger taste than you would have here.
Now, moving on, I want to talk a little bit about your work with Alliance Française. What do you do with them?
So I am the executive director, and I've been with the Alliance Française for about the past 18 years. But the Alliance Française de Milwaukee was founded in 1918, so we are 98 years old. We're going to have our 100th anniversary in a couple years. And it's significant that it was in 1918. That's the end of World War One, and especially in 1918, Milwaukee was very much of a German city, which, as you know, in World War One was, on the opposite side of France and the U.S. So it's interesting that the Alliance Française had this presence already in Milwaukee at that time.
Now, I want to go back to the Bastille Day celebrations that are starting today in Milwaukee. They're going to go through the weekend. What can we expect there? It's not going to be quite the same scene as it will be in France itself, but what happens here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin?
Well, in Milwaukee, there's music just pretty much during the whole 4 days and the 13 hours of the festival. There is incredible food, and this year, in addition to our stand where we make the beignets, there's Bartolotta's Lake Park Bistro, La Niappe, Press, Le Rêve, and I'm skipping others, but the quality of the food is absolutely amazing this year. So we have the beignets. Bartolotta's has, a croque monsieur and a hot dog. La Niappe has escargot.
Snails,
has
right?
And waffles. Yes, snails. Le Rêve has macaroons. I mean, it's just absolutely exquisite food. And in addition, there's wine tasting, champagne tasting, French music. I mean, it's almost like being in France when you're at Bastille Days now.
So if someone wanted to be really adventurous and try those snails, I've never tried them. What do they taste like?
Well, snails don't taste like very much. the important thing is the sauce that goes with it. They're delicious, and La Niappe is a very high caliber restaurant, and you will definitely love them.
And you don't have to be French to understand what's going on, right?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Anne LaPlay, Executive Director of the Alliance Française de Milwaukee, and she joined us to talk about the history of the French people in Wisconsin. Today is Bastille Day, the day to commemorate the storming of the Bastille. It's being celebrated in Milwaukee's Cathedral Park starting today and going through the weekend.
There's a lot of information out there about gluten in our diets, some good, some bad, and some ugly, as in this exchange in the movie, This Is the End.
Gluten's a vague term. It's something that's used to categorize things that are bad. Calories, that's a gluten. Fat, that's a gluten.
Somebody just told you probably shouldn't eat gluten. You're like, oh, I guess I shouldn't eat gluten.
A lot of people have a better handle on the concept of gluten than Seth Rogen, but our next guest says media hype and misinformation often lead people to make bad health decisions and often to go on gluten-free diets when they don't actually need to.
Rory Jones is with us now. She's a science writer and adjunct professor of narrative medicine at Columbia University's Barnard College. She's the co-author with Dr. Peter Green of the book Celiac Disease, A Hidden Epidemic, and the book we're talking about now, Gluten Exposed. Rory, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Let's start by straightening things out for those movie stars there. What is gluten, really?
Well, gluten is the protein portion of wheat, rye, and barley. Gluten is the multi-system ravager in today's media frenzy, which you pointed out. Wheat, rye, and barley also have carbohydrate contents to them, but gluten is the actual protein part of it.
Seems like part of what makes gluten and eating gluten such a tricky issue is that there are some people who really do have celiac disease or other conditions, but most people don't, and a gluten-free diet isn't going to help them necessarily. So is that part of what's making things confusing for people looking at this?
I think so. That's part of it. And they're reading a lot of pseudoscience, pointing fingers at different things. 1% of the population, approximately, has celiac disease. But interestingly, only about 17% of that population has been actually diagnosed. So you actually have a lot of people out there who may get sick when they eat gluten, but haven't been diagnosed with celiac diseases yet. Some of these people go on a gluten-free diet, say that they're feeling better, and they categorize themselves as being gluten sensitive, gluten intolerant. But as long as you are tested, this is the group, the people with celiac disease, who really cannot eat it.
A lot of people might say, hey, even if I don't have celiac, there's no harm in going gluten-free, so why not? So is gluten-free harmless for most people?
Actually, it's not a healthy diet. Even for people with celiac disease who are on it, who have to be very, very careful. The problem with the diet is that people think it's one healthy. And the gluten-free diet is wheat itself, I'll go back to wheat. Wheat itself is a very healthy grain. It is loaded with fiber, vitamins, and minerals. When you take it out of someone's diet, because it's in many, many things that we eat, it's in cereal, it's in bread, and all of the wheat flours and a lot of the wheat products are fortified with vitamins and minerals. The gluten-free products are not. So a gluten-free diet, when you take this out, is low in fiber, it's low in vitamins, and it's low in many minerals. And when you add back gluten-free foods that are made with extra sugar and fat, you're putting these things back in a diet that doesn't need it. It also has increased levels of heavy metals because it's heavily rice and corn-based. The rice itself naturally absorbs arsenic from groundwater. So people who eat a lot of gluten-free products, which have a lot of rice in them, are getting a very high level. They've done studies on this. They show very high levels of mercury and arsenic and other things. So the bottom line of the healthy part of a gluten-free diet is that if you do not put back the vitamins, minerals, and fiber that you're taking out, it's not healthy for you at all.
That's one of your recommendations of the book. Someone going gluten-free for any reason, good or bad, is best off talking to a nutritionist to make sure they make up for what they're missing.
Yes, yes. And a lot of people just go to the internet or they go to a friend and someone says to them, well, this is what I'm doing. And a lot of others, people who come to the Celiac Center in New York, many, many of them, as Peter Green talks about a great deal, are B vitamin deficient. Quite heavily so. They have B12, B6 deficiencies. And if you're not being followed by a doctor and or a nutritionist, this can go in a very bad direction.
We're talking to Rory Jones. She's co-author of the book Gluten Exposed, Trying to Untangle Fact from Fiction when it comes to gluten in our diets. So, Rory, a lot of people have probably thought, oh, I've got this stomach ailment or that other one, I think I might have celiac. I might be gluten intolerant, something like that. So if somebody's thinking that, what's the best way for them to try to figure out, okay, is this really the deal? Do they really need to avoid gluten?
They should get tested. It is a very straightforward, simple blood test that is available from their doctor. And the test, there's one very good test that is about 90%. It's called the TTG. It's a tissue transglutaminase, IgA. And if they have this test and it proves to be very positive, they follow up with an intestinal biopsy, and they will then know whether or not they have celiac disease. And if they don't, the doctor can also figure out what else is going on.
Now, here's where the problem starts for a lot of people. People go in thinking they have celiac, and you write about this in the book. They get the test. They say, nope, no celiac. That's not your problem. It's another cause. But they still think they do. So what do you say to those people who don't agree with the test, who keep believing they have celiac or something like it and behaving accordingly?
Well, there are two sides to that. One is when people have a very firmly held belief that this is what is wrong with them, the more you try to convince them that that's not the case, the more firmly they will hold the belief. They've done actual studies on that. The other is that if they're at a physician, the physician can try to find out what else might be at play. A lot of these people may have irritable bowel syndrome. And a lot of people, when they take gluten out of their diet, they are reacting to the carbohydrate side of it. And they may have what is known as, which we write about, is a FODMAP sensitivity. FODMAP is an acronym for the many carbohydrates, the complex ones, the fructose, the sucrose, that are found in many foods, garlic, onions, wheat has fructans. And by taking gluten out of their diet, they're actually lowering their FODMAP content, and that's making them feel better.
So, in effect, they're accidentally curing themselves a little bit, is what you're saying.
It may be. It may be. And the other thing that one can do is have a gene test, because there are two specific genes, DQ2, DQ8, which everyone with celiac disease has. And if you don't have those two genes, you will not have celiac disease. And that can definitely be ruled out.
Now, this all leads to another concern that you and your co-author raise in this book, that people who, in effect, self-diagnose with gluten intolerance or celiac disease, might be making it impossible to diagnose what's actually causing whatever problems they're having. It can get in the way, right?
Yes, absolutely. I think that we've come in because of the internet and a lot of media that people really feel that they can solve their problems by changing their eating behaviors. And there's a new condition which you may be familiar with called orthorexia nervosa, and it is a version of anorexia where people, because they feel it's healthy, start to remove one thing after another from their diet. They start with gluten, and then they decide that they're somewhat lactose intolerant. They take out all of the calcium-rich dairy in their diet, and then they're told that meat isn't good for them, so they take the meat out. One by one, they are taking out all the healthy parts of the diet, and they come to the doctor malnourished. And orthorexia has taken hold where people really think that they can eliminate food and make themselves better.
And you write in the book that actually the way we work, we've evolved as omnivores. Generally, lots of variety tends to be a good thing as long as, you know, we don't have really particular sensitivities to a particular food.
Absolutely. Eating healthy, variety is the key. And there's, as we're fond of saying, there are these things called fruit, vegetables, fish, meat, and dairy that are food, that are the best things for you.
Maybe one of our problems is we tend to oversimplify when we think of what's going on in our guts. It's, I input A, this food or whatever, B is the output, that's all it is. It turns out, reading your book, our guts are really, really complicated. You refer to them as the second brain
right.
at some points. So
right.
How complicated is what's going on down there?
The second brain refers to the neurological component of what's going on. I mean, our gut operates independent of conscious thought, right? You don't have to think, well, I have to digest my food. The same way that your heart beats without your brain having to tell you that it's going to make your heart beat. So all of this going on in your gut is very well controlled by the nervous system in there. You also have what's called a microbiome. I mean, we've grown with what used to be called neural flora and fauna with trillions of bacteria that taste various things and tell our immune system this is safe and this is not safe. And when people start to tinker with the way the gut normally is used to working, they can get in a lot of trouble, and they can really mess things up. And people also take a tremendous amount of supplements and vitamins because they think it's healthier. So instead of eating food, they're eating pills.
We're talking to Rory Jones. She's co-author of the new book, Gluten Exposed. She's trying to separate fact from fiction when it comes to gluten in our diets, celiac disease, and how our body deals with wheat and other sources of gluten.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about gluten or about celiac disease? Have you been diagnosed with celiac disease? If you've gone gluten-free under the advice of your doctor, how has that worked out? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about gluten and gluten-free diets. Our guest is Rory Jones, co-author of the book Gluten Exposed, and she's trying to help separate fact from fiction when it comes to gluten.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is gluten a concern in your life and your family? Have you given it up with or without a doctor's advice? Do you have celiac disease? Do you think gluten-free has turned into a fad for a lot of people? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Rory, we've been mostly talking about people who don't have celiac disease here. In the book, you also give a lot of advice for people who do have it, who do have to go gluten-free. And you talk about dealing with the absence of those foods physically, nutritionally, and kind of mentally, too. Can you give a bit of advice for people who really are having to give up gluten?
Sure. I think the first thing you have to remember is to eat food, to move away from processed food as much as you can, because if you have celiac disease, a lot of processed food has hidden gluten in it. So eating healthy is important, and that doesn't, you know, the natural doesn't mean healthy. It means adding gluten-free grains back into your diet for fiber and vitamins and minerals, quinoa, oats, lentils, chickpeas, buckwheat. Buckwheat is not wheat. Eat food rather than vitamin pills, which is very important. Vitamins have their own side effects. You can have way, way too many of them or not enough. As far as you mentioned the mental side of it, any restrictive diet after a period of time, for those of us who have to be on it, is stressful. And stress loads the prefrontal cortex in our brain, which makes us anxious. And after a period of time, this can cause a lot of issues. So I think it's really important for you to get used to the diet, to learn to ask questions, be prepared. It's especially hard for teenagers, I think, who want to be with their friends and want to be like everybody else, and all of a sudden everyone's out having pizza and beer, and you can't. So there are lots of sides of it, and it's a process. I think it takes time, and if you put your mind to it that you will find other foods that you like eating, you'll be able to get through this much, much better.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Diane on the line in Richmond, Illinois. Diane, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Diane?
I almost drove off the side of the road listening to the author. My daughter went to a gastroenterologist, and she got tested for celiacs, and she turned out she does not have celiacs. But she wasn't eating gluten, so she felt much better not eating gluten. So the gastroenterologist said, okay, if you feel better, then don't eat them. But then she started cutting out dairy, and then now she feels better if she doesn't eat meat. So when I heard all those things, I identified with that because my daughter's doing all those same things that the author talked about, cutting out the gluten and the dairy and now the meat. And it's just, I'm definitely going to go out and buy that book and show it to my daughter because it's she's doing all those things.
Diane, thanks a lot for that call. And Rory, someone in Diane's daughter's position, I mean, we won't go deeply into her medical diagnosis here, obviously, but somebody who's kind of winging it and eliminating one food, then another food, and another food, what would you recommend as another approach for her and maybe a doctor to try to pin down what's been causing her problems?
Well, the best approach is what her mother has just suggested, which is to read some of the facts about this and to try to convince her daughter to add some of these things back a little bit at a time to see if perhaps she'll feel better eating some of it. Also, to supplement her diet so that you are replacing the dairy with lots of calcium. You are replacing the gluten with fiber and vitamin and mineral-rich foods. And there are people who don't eat meat, but you can eat, hopefully, chicken and fish so that she's getting enough protein. But some of these conditions, the kids think they have them, but they don't really. They've done so many studies with placebos that if you think it's the placebo-nocebo effect, that you think if you take it out, you feel better. And you do feel better because you think you will. So there's a mental process going on here that has to be addressed as well.
Diane, thanks for the call. Good luck to your daughter. We'll go next to Charles in Verona. Charles, hi.
Hello.
Would you want to tell us about Charles?
Well, I have a little bit of neuropathy in my feet, and one of my sons has a horrible amount of it. And if he eats a little bit of gluten, he just has all kinds of pain, shoots up his legs, feet sore. Recently, my wife she tenderized meat using whatever tenderizer, and he had some of that, and my gosh, he called up and said, what did you put in that food? And
so, Charles, before I throw this over to Rory, I want to ask, have you or your son been diagnosed with any kind of celiac disease or gluten intolerance?
Not celiac disease. I'm sure we don't have that. But
all right.
Gluten intolerance, I think for my son, it's pretty obvious he has a problem.
Charles, thanks a lot for that call. Rory, is that a thing, neuropathy, that weird feeling in your extremities, sometimes feet in this case, a pain associated with gluten?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, peripheral neuropathies are one of the symptoms of celiac disease. And Charles has just said, I'm sure that we don't have celiac disease, but until he and his son are tested, they won't know that. And it's very possible neuropathy clinics refer patients to gastroenterologists all the time, and they find that they do have celiac disease. So I think the first thing for him to do, and for his, certainly for his son, is to get tested.
All right. Well, Charles, thanks a lot. Hope that helps for you and your son in particular. We're talking to Rory Jones, co-author of the new book, Gluten Exposed. Back to our callers now with Jackie in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. Jackie, hi.
Hi. I have had heartburn all my life, very bad. And then I went to about 10 different doctors to see if they could figure out what was wrong, and they kept just telling me to take an acid. Nobody could figure out what was wrong, so I stopped eating wheat, and the heartburn went away. And then I thought, well, maybe I have celiac. So I hadn't been eating wheat probably for about 6 years. By that time, I went and asked the doctor to test me for celiac. She did a blood test and said I didn't have celiac, but if I eat wheat, I get sick, and I get this horrible, horrible stomach aches and heartburn. So what do I do?
Well, it sounds as if, I mean, I am not a doctor. I mean, it sounds as if you have a form of reflux. If the doctor discussed this with you, which is why he's giving you antacids, and the problem with being on antacids for a long period of time is there are issues related to that, because they are killing the stomach acid that normally kills all the bugs that come through you. There are tests for reflux, and there are reflux diets that could help. And it's possible that gluten is playing a part in here, but it's also possible by eliminating a number of other foods that form part of this reflux diet that you'll be able to solve the problem and eat gluten again.
Jackie, thanks a lot for the call. Rory, I wanted to talk to you about some of the cutting-edge research. You list some different ongoing research efforts to try to deal with celiac disease, potential vaccine, and other cures maybe on the horizon. What's out there?
Well, there's a lot in the pipeline. There are a number of enzymes that are showing a lot of promise in their ability to degrade gluten. There are other things that are working to seal up what is called leaky gut. That's not a medical term. Most of the enzymes and the intestinal permeability blockers are being used with a gluten-free diet in case there's an occasional indiscretion. The vaccine, which is showing a great deal of promise, is going into testing now. It is much like the shots that are given for allergies, where you have to take them every week. So it's a matter of developing them so that they will be tolerable to patients as well. But that's all in the pipeline, and that's still pretty far down the road.
So right now it's still all about controlling diet if you do have celiac.
Correct, because that is a known treatment that works, and it has no side effects. And that's the other part of drug testing. You have to make sure that that doesn't have negative side effects for the patient.
Rory, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Rory Jones. She's co-author with Dr. Peter Green of the new book, Gluten Exposed. They've also written a book called Celiac Disease, A Hidden Epidemic. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a link to some information about Gluten Exposed. And tell us if you've gone gluten-free, why not, and what difference it might have made.
Some big news about a really old but really well-loved eagle this week. Old Abe was a mascot during the Civil War. He traveled with the 8th Wisconsin Infantry Regiment and was even wounded in battle.
Not too long ago here on Central Time, we talked about some doubt on whether or not Old Abe was actually a boy eagle. Some rumors said the big secret was that Old Abe should have been Old Abby. that Old Abe was a girl all along. The official taxidermist who stuffed Old Abe after the eagle died confirmed and said, yes, the rumors were true. Old Abe was a girl.
Well, it's not the end of the story. Enter modern science. The University of Wisconsin's Biotechnology Center Molecular Archaeology Group just tested DNA from Old Abe. And guess what? Old Abe is a boy eagle after all.
Now, there had been rumors that Old Abe had laid eggs, which only a female eagle could do. But we had some old-timey newspapers we were looking at, and there was speculation that, no, the colonel who was supposedly eating eagle eggs was eating goose eggs instead. And it was a big goose egg on the number of eagle eggs actually being laid.
I guess DNA puts it to rest. You can't really argue with this.
I can't.
I guess there you go. Old Abe, boy eagle.
So a Wisconsin musical tribute to Old Abe here on Central Time. I want to fly like an eagle.